out there. This is Positive Outcomes, a podcast for the P&O community. Thank you for joining us. I'm Simon Beals, your host for this episode. We have a really special show for you today. We have Linda Lasko and Scott Headland of Orthotics Prosthetics Canada are with us today, and we're going to discuss kind of some of the important issues and challenges that are facing the P&O community here in Canada. Now, I've had the privilege of working with both Scott and Linda. Linda is not only the current president of OPC, but she's a certified orthotist with over 25 years of experience and is a managing partner at Custom Orthotic Design Group in Ontario. Scott is the current vice president of OPC, as well as a certified prosthetist and owner of Russell Prosthetics in BC. Thank you both for coming on, Linda and Scott. Okay.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah. Glad
to be Thanks, here. Simon.
So I think we're going to format this maybe a little bit differently than when we've done some of our other podcasts, in that this is going to be a little bit more kind of a round table discussion. So kind of very, very free flowing, and kind of we'll see where it takes us. But I thought as a starting point for us, maybe we can look at having you kind of outline the role and responsibilities of OPC here in Canada.
Again, thanks for having us, and it's a nice opportunity for us to outline what we do at Orthotics Prosthetics Canada. First of all, we are responsible to the patients to lead the advancements of prosthetics and orthotics here in Canada. And we do that by developing and maintaining standards for our members, to credential the members and provide educational opportunities, and to advocate for and to promote the profession to the public as well as to other healthcare professionals.
So who do you work with directly? As OPC, who does OPC have relationships with?
OPC, we have quite a broad reach. We have quite close relationships with ISPO, with ABC and BOC in the United States, as well as some other international organizations. But internally as well, we have a quite close relationship with the regional associations as well. We have a regional council, which meets two or three times a year to discuss provincial issues across the country, as well as looking for ways that OPC can support some of those initiatives with some background information and also some other help in different ways.
I guess being a national organization, there's some challenges. I mean, when we talk with our partners down in the U.S., you know, we describe Canada as, you know, one country made up of 10 different countries because of the differences within the provinces in terms of reimbursements and funding and you know, so forth and so on. That must be a challenge as in terms of how OPC is able to kind of look at kind of Canada as a country, but then you've got input from all of the different provinces as well.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be some pretty distinct roles as far as national efforts and provincial efforts. OPC is looking after, we generally are looking after all of our regulation and all of our credentialing issues and all of our national and some of the international relations that we have. Whereas the provincial associations or regional associations will deal more with their respective funding agencies. So yeah, there are some pretty distinct roles in there as far as, you know, what OPC's mandate is and what the regional associations' mandates are.
We keep an eye on that, though, because there are some funding agencies such as NIHB and DVA and some of the bigger third-party insurance companies that are across Canada that we do talk with and support and help provide them information about what our certified members do. And then behind that, we will also provide support to the regional associations. So we've recently worked closely with the POABC and OAPO, so BC and Ontario, in some of their strategies and working through funding with their provincial governments. So we're here for support for that, but also to advocate for all of our members with those national bodies.
So what are some of the challenges that we're facing as a community on that national level? What are some of the areas that are foremost in people's minds?
Well, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but in some ways, encroachment is a really big issue nationally as well as provincially and internationally, for that matter. You know, we see this a lot, especially in orthotics. We have been trying to work a little bit better and a little bit more closely with some of the other allied health professionals who do tend to have a little bit of overlapping scope to really make sure that the patient is taken care of. But I mean, that's a that seems to be an issue that we're facing quite a bit across the country. There's also, I guess, some of the 3D printed and sort of maker movement type devices that really make their rounds on social media, or some of these stories are making their rounds on social media. That tends to provide some challenges that we sometimes get involved in as well.
So something like that, that's a really interesting point, because, you know, as I go across and I visit, you know, multiple clinics, I would say, you know, an overwhelming number have a 3D printing device sitting kind of in the lab somewhere. What does that look like? What type of implications are there?
There's a number of different ways to look at it, I guess. It depends on which way you're viewing it. From an external perspective, you know, we see challenges in that the way that some of these stories are posed online is that we see what appears to be an apples to apples comparison between a $20 arm that's out there somewhere that kind of looks like a Lego arm. And, you know, sometimes they are compared in those stories to, you know, $100,000 myoelectric, you know, pretty advanced devices. So there's some challenges there from that perspective, in that the actual fabrication of a device on a 3D printer, the cost of materials can be quite cheap, but when you're looking at what that device does, how it interacts with the patient, the safety, the testing, all of the follow-up care that's provided with it, you know, there's really no comparison between the two of them. So the perception there is a pretty challenging one to deal with. When it comes to fabrication, and when it comes to O&P clinics having a 3D printer in their office, that's you know, that's an exciting and up and coming thing. That's a new and exciting fabrication pathway that's starting to challenge some of our traditional fabrication methods. So that's a whole other ball of wax there, Simon.
So now, how does OPC approach kind of the first presentation of that? What type of things is OPC able to do to kind of raise awareness that we're not talking about apples to apples in terms of a particular device or something that's being shown, especially on social media?
I think it's important that OPC recognizes that the new technologies are out there and our members are working towards using them and integrating them into practice. So you see them in a lot of different places, because we want to stay on top of the technology. At the same time, we want to make sure that we're advocating for the patients that they're getting the most appropriate treatment for them that includes all the thorough assessment and following up and that integration with their body of that device. And so when we're talking about it and when we're advocating to insurance agencies or the public, we're telling them, yes, our members are getting involved with this, we're learning about it, we're staying on top of it, but we still have to remember the important integration of that medical device with a human body. And we're doing it in a very careful way. We have talked about, I think there's a white paper on the 3D printing so far, and we've been doing some background work in that. We're not going to stomp all over it, but we're not going to jump in right away. We need to be careful how we treat people. And I think that's more of our stance, and use the evidence that's available and create more evidence to show if it's a positive thing for the patients or something that's not so good. And I think that when people post things on social media about 3D printing, they often forget all of the background research that was done, the cost of the equipment and machinery and supplies, and the cost of any sort of follow-up and treatment on the medical side. When they post that, oh, this arm was $25 and this one was $25,000, they don't compare the whole package of treatment that would be provided by a certified prosthetist to what was given to them by that person from their basement.
Yeah, education is key there, I think. And, you know, I see a large part of our role as providing the education and the clinical justification and evidence around our treatment. A 3D printer is another, it's pretty exciting, but it is ultimately another fabrication pathway. So our traditional methods still work.
How do we get that education out into the public? And who does that education need to be directed towards?
Yeah. So that's a challenging thing for us to get the knowledge to the public, because if we were to do some sort of big media campaign, it would be well beyond any budget that we ever have as far as print or on TV or online. And then we need to have the ability to develop all the messages that we need to send out. So it's challenging to teach them. I know a lot of us work with educating our allied healthcare professionals as to, okay, yeah, I know you saw this on TV that I can just do this on a 3D printer, but then when I provide them with education as to what challenges we have, how we're working with it, and how we're working towards it, they understand, okay, it's not ready yet. It's not something that's been tested on a patient. It's not something we can jump in and do right away. And that's how a lot of it's being done. We are working on another initiative that isn't 3D printing. It's more of, I guess I could talk about a little bit about helmet treatments for children with plagiocephaly. We have a group together of volunteers that are putting together some messaging for the public about this whole treatment and how to go about getting it done and what it's for and the safe way to do it. So we've got volunteers that take the evidence and are going to be providing it to the public. It's just we can't do it all at the same time where we've got limited volunteers and limited funds to do all this education.
Absolutely. So I guess that leads into kind of some of the other areas. So we touched on right at the beginning, one of the challenges that the community faces is encroachment, overlapping scope of practice. Where obviously is a priority issue for OPC and for the entire community. What type of steps are being taken? Are there any initiatives from OPC in terms of, again, kind of education or...
We've got several initiatives going on right now and quite big ones. The main one is our National Education Standards Project, and it was developed out of a big meeting and roundtable that we brought in many stakeholders and came to several conclusions about what directions we should go with our education here in Canada. And the first step in that right now that we're working on is to conduct a new practice analysis. So about 8 years ago, we did a practice analysis, and this is a big survey that goes to all our members to understand exactly what we're doing it and how we're doing it and what are the most important activities we're doing and how much time are we putting into it, how much money is going into it. And once we have all that information, that helps us drive a lot of other activities that we're going to be doing through the National Education Standards Project, including developing or updating the competencies that we have for our accredited schools, updating our residency and internship programs, updating our certification examinations, updating MCE requirements, updating our scope of practice and standards of ethics. So it's a lot of very objective information that gets pumped into the whole system and helps us build that up. And when we have that, so we have that practice analysis from before, and with that information and then with the new information, we'll go on to continue our communications with the stakeholder relations. So those would be the funding agencies that we had talked about earlier, as well as different educational institutions. Can they or are they interested in maybe opening up another prosthetics or orthotics educational, accredited educational facility, and working with allied healthcare team members? Okay, we can say to them, this is what the evidence is showing us. This is what we're doing. This is how we can help you care for your patients. And then, of course, any initiatives that we have going to the public. But it's that practice analysis and that data gathering that we're doing right now that's going to be informing us as we move forward with the other information.
Those sound like huge initiatives and a lot of them.
Yeah, it's really a big pyramid that all this data gets collected from all of our membership and stakeholders, and then it gets pumped into the different committees and into their work. So, for example, that practice analysis data will be given to our certification registration board and through their crosswalk process, and they sort of take that data and analyze what percentages of the exam should be tested on what areas and what competencies. And then they work with a professional examination company to update the exams. So it seems like a lot of work, and it is, because it's mostly done by volunteers, but it's very guided by evidence and best practices. So it's not like we're making this up as we go.
The schools themselves and the number of new grads that are coming out from the schools, do you ever see that number increasing?
That's one thing that we are working towards. And one of the initiatives from the education project is that we need to have more graduates, and both clinical and technical. And I'm really excited to talk about George Brown College in Toronto. They went from 8 students last year to 10 students, and they have 2 students being educated in Manitoba with a consortium of practitioners there. So that we're really excited about that. It's very positive outcomes coming from that. The second intake was this year, so now we have 4 students learning in Manitoba. BCIT is having some changes as well as they move into their new building. Scott might be able to speak to that, but we are making changes there. It's just very slow process.
Yeah, these things are, they're things that have been talked about for a long time. And again, it's there's a lot of moving pieces in there. So it's exciting to see a lot of that take shape, especially with the remote learning situation with Manitoba and George Brown. You know, it's really exciting. And the new BCIT building is pretty fantastic. There's lots of talk as well and some work towards a Western technical school as well. So there's some movement there. It's a much needed hole that we're looking at patching up as well.
I know from conversations with facilities right the way across the country, you know, it's often a question that gets asked is like, do you know any technicians? Do you know any technicians? We are in desperate need of technical. Do you see that? Is that kind of a topic of conversation that you see?
Routinely, yeah. It's something.
I think it depends where you are.
Okay, so it's a regionality to it?
Yeah, because we hired a technician, I think it's about 6 months ago. We put up an ad and I had several applicants. We hired someone and we've gotten busier since. So we've hired somebody else and there are people there, but they're not willing to move out of Toronto area. They want to be in this area. And I think that's where opening up a technical school in BC would be a huge asset to our profession, because then we'd have people from BC or from the West that want to stay there and work.
And is it part of the role of kind of OPC to control or determine the number of licensed, registered clinicians and technicians within the O&P field? I've never actually thought about it, but who dictates how many kind of people are within this field? I mean, medical schools will, you know, graduate X number of physicians and, you know, they control that number. Is that a role that OPC is involved with, or is that something that's at the level of the institutions?
It's a bit hand in hand. You know, the supply of professionals, or there's been a projected and experienced shortage of professionals entering into the field for longer, 10 years at least. It's been identified and we've been working towards it. Again, there's a lot of moving pieces to it. It's coordination with the schools. It's not something that OPC is looking to limit or control in from that respect. It's something that we are trying to look for new pathways for satisfying that need for professionals in Canada.
I think it's dictated by the capabilities of each individual school. So OPC sets the standards for the school for them to be accredited by OPC, but the school themselves sets the number of students that they can accommodate for. So we're not able to tell them, like I can't say to GBC, okay, you need to have more seats, because they can only work within the resources that they have.
Right. Do you think that there is a need for more professionals within O&P?
There's a huge increase of people with disabilities coming through. People are living longer. They're living with more comorbidities, more issues with their physical abilities. So we have a lot more people requiring prosthetics and orthotics care. And we have this tsunami of people with diabetes coming in as well. That's really increasing the number of people that need care. So we need to address that. And for many years, our membership through different surveys has shown that our numbers are sort of flattening out. They were flattening out. They're starting to increase a little bit now, but that we're going to need to have more members to meet that need. And we're doing that with the schools and the National Education Standards Project, but also we have quite a few people that are immigrating to Canada and going through our pathway to become recognized by OPC.
And so let's kind of switch the conversation completely 180 degrees from the initiatives that are being undertaken by OPC to kind of our members. What can they do, you know, kind of to support ABC? We've kind of talked about what OPC is doing for kind of the membership. Is there something that the membership can be doing to support the initiatives at OPC?
Well, would suggest it's get engaged, get involved, take on volunteer roles. It's a great way to internally and from a selfish perspective, it's a great way to get to know some of your colleagues across the country and also get to know more about the profession and contribute. I've gotten a lot out of all the volunteer roles that I've taken on over the years. So it's something that I encourage anybody to just get out there and take something on, either provincially or nationally. With respect to OPC, we're always looking for new volunteers for committees or for ad hoc groups or task forces. So there's plenty of work out there to be done.
I think too that starting at grassroots level, even with our residents and interns, and whenever they have the opportunity to speak to allied healthcare professions or members of our communities, whether it's at a day at a high school talking about professions, like a professional day, talking to doctors, physios about what we do and our credentialing and just educating the public, that's a great thing to do if you don't have time to volunteer. Making sure that you conduct or complete all of the surveys that OPC sends out, especially our practice analysis. If you get one, you get that, we want you to fill it out. And like Scott said, being a volunteer, most of our work is done by volunteers. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of hours are put towards all the different committees each year. And there we meet so many interesting people and have so many opportunities to do different things with these volunteer groups that it's well worthwhile spending some time, whether it's an hour a month or an hour a year or 40 hours a month, it's worthwhile to be involved.
Yeah, I was raised a great point. You know, when you say hundreds of thousands of hours, that can be a very daunting number for somebody to hear. You know, do you have kind of a comment or an answer if somebody says, well, maybe I'd like to get involved, but, you know, everybody's super busy in clinic. You know, I don't have the time to kind of be a president or a vice president of OPC.
Yeah, just start small. It doesn't take much. Every little bit helps. There are some pretty low time demand types of scenarios. And as Linda was mentioning, even to a degree, even filling out a survey is doing some volunteer work. So, you know, it's just little bits, do your part, you know, not to browbeat. Some people just do not have the time and I fully respect that. It's not for everybody, but again, personally, I've gotten a lot out of it and I've made some really good friends through a lot of the work that I've done with OPC and with POABC.
I think getting involved, like I first started doing a little bit with our provincial association, just going to the meetings to start off with. And then I helped with one little project and it was sort of built up. And I think I'm in an easier position than a lot of people is that my partner is in the field as well and understands the contributions and we have our practice together and we don't have children that are dependent on us anymore. So I'm able to put time in. And when I had young children and we were starting our practice, I didn't have any time for it. But I made sure that I was able to go to different doctors and educate about, it was CBC back then, but about OPC and about our profession, not just about my practice, but about our profession. And so every opportunity that we had, we would speak to it. And little things like that make a big difference. If that doctor keeps hearing from different sources that they want an OPC certifee looking after their patients, then they're more likely to refer to an OPC certifee.
Yeah. And do you find that the kind of the new entrants, so the residents and then the new certifees are kind of eager to join in and kind of begin to take that role as they will be the leaders down the road?
I think it's a little hard with OPC because we are credentialing them. So we need to have a little bit of a hands-off perspective when they work right with OPC. But with work with ISPO Canada, we have active residents on the board of directors who contribute to any initiatives that we do, especially things like social media and reaching out and increasing our membership. They're great at it because they know how to put those Instagram posts out way better than I do.
Absolutely. And do you find that, again, that there's a broader contact with the allied health professionals from kind of younger practitioners as they've come into the field, you know, as they go into kind of OMP, some of their friends may go into physio, some of their friends might become docs and so forth, and that you have more of that kind of interdisciplinary communication?
I don't know.
It's the same. I'm not sure if it would stand to reason that as there is a bigger connection and longer time within the educational institutes that there would be more of those connections made on a kind of an interpersonal level with people in different programs and different allied health fields. So I would stand to reason. That's purely speculation at this point. From my perspective, but I could see that happening. I'd like to know more about that.
I think you might see that with the students that go through the McMaster program. So the McMaster Master of Science in Rehab program that some of our BCIT, GBC, and also OPC members are doing, it's an interdisciplinary course where you're actually working with other allied healthcare professionals. So in that respect, those people that are taking that course together, they would have more interactions. And I think the healthcare professionals that are taking it have a better understanding of what prosthetics and orthotics is about. So I think in that respect, they would.
Excellent. Excellent. So fine, just before we kind of close out, are there any kind of, you know, we talked about some of the initiatives that OPC is taking. Are there any kind of final take homes that you'd like kind of people that are listening to this podcast to either to remember, or, you know, I always like kind of juicy tidbits of what's coming down the pipe, you know, what people can look forward to, that type of thing?
Well, I think one thing that's exciting is that we're going for our reaccreditation with ISPO. So our pathway of becoming a certified orthotist or prosthetist is accredited by the International Society for Prosthetics and Orthotics, and they're reaccrediting us coming up this year. And so that gives us some outside validation of what we do and how we do it, showing basically the world that OPC didn't make this stuff up. Other people are saying, yes, you're doing it properly. This is the best way to have prosthetic or orthotic care for your patients. And so that's exciting. And then our national practice analysis is coming up probably in the summer or fall. So watch for that. We really want everyone to complete it. I think we had a record-breaking respondent rate last time, and we want to beat that this time. So keep that in mind.
Absolutely. Scott, anything?
Yeah, it's just I'm racking my brain trying to think of some of the other initiatives that we're working on. There's a lot on the go. You know, we're doing some foundational work on a national time study or time coding database. We're just doing some background work on that before we launch into doing the rubber hitting the road work on it. Yeah, the regional council is always a great thing. We're doing a lot of work through that to support the regions and to also establish relationships across regions that really helps with some of the provincial funding issues that are going on. We're also involved in a global initiative called Global ONP. It started out of Australia, and it's more of an association, an international association for ONP providers. So that's up and coming. So that's a pretty exciting initiative that we're involved with.
Yeah. Excellent.
There's a website up for that, ONP Global. I think www.ompglobal.org. And that's really exciting, but very, very new.
That's
secret.
My nugget. That's my nugget.
That's your nugget, Simon.
Okay, excellent. And of course, we can't forget that hopefully, fingers crossed, in August, OPC convention in Whistler.
Mm-hmm. Whistler, BC, yeah, it's coming up. It's exciting. The world will be such that we can travel a bit more and have a bit more in-person attendance to that one. Though our virtual conference this past summer was pretty well attended. It'd be nice to see everybody again and, you know, maybe pick up the bats and the gloves and have a bit of a softball game in there somewhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. It'll be nice to connect with everybody right the way across the country. I think we probably all have stories to share and experiences that everybody can relate to. So it would be nice for everybody to be gathered together. And Whistler's a darn good place to do it, I think.
Yes.
Not so bad.
Yeah. Not that I got to vote in it, but if I had a vote in it, yes, I think that's a darn good place to have it.
Yeah. BC's nice. Don't tell anybody.
And I think with that, I would just like to say thank you so much for taking the time today to record this podcast with us. It's greatly appreciated.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was fun.
And with that, I'd like to thank everybody as well for listening to this episode. Of course, if you have any show or topic ideas for future episodes, you can email us at positiveoutcomes@orthoped.ca. New episodes are available every other Thursday at positiveoutcomes.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to the show on your podcast app to receive updates. And if you enjoy the show, be sure to give us a 5-star rating. Positive Outcomes is a production of Orthoped ULC, conjunction with our partners, produced by Jonathan Stone and Frederic Sauvé, and hosted by me, Simon Beals, and Jeff Newell. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.